Hey, welcome to another edition of Old School Guns. This is episode 34. And if you like what you hear in this podcast, go ahead and hit the subscribe button, the like button, the following button, whatever it is you can push. We're on Podbean, iTunes, kind of on YouTube also, I guess. Nice part about YouTube is they have much better quality sound, I found. But anyway, we are there and we can come to you through your computer or through your phone. So anyway, welcome to another episode of the podcast. Today we're going to do something a little special. We are going to do a book review, which will consist of the entire show. The reason is there's really not that much news to talk about out there. Democrats are threatening gun control. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors made idiots out of themselves, declaring NRA terrorists, you know, and the usual kind of antics and stuff that's out there. So other than waste a lot of time commenting on that, I thought I would do something different. And instead of our political and gun media commentary, we are going to do a book review. And this is a book that kind of hits the, it's out there in kind of the preparedness, survivalist area, but it's probably out there with some trainers and things too. And this book is called Guerrilla Gunfighter 2, Preparedness Rifle and Carbine. And it's by a gentleman who goes by the pen name of John Mosby, taking the name of the Civil War guerrilla, unconventional warfare guy is really what he was, John S. Mosby, who was probably one of the most successful Confederate commanders, a personal hero of mine, a guy who really understood warfare and really understood asymmetric warfare before those things even were thought of as terms or as concepts. But talking about Guerrilla Gunfighter 2, there is a Guerrilla Gunfighter 1 which really talks about the pistol. And, pistols are fine. There's been literally, you could fill an entire library with enough books that have been done on pistol fighting. Our rifles, a lot less. So I thought this would be pretty interesting to kind of gauge the work, if you will. I first heard about this. There's a gentleman I used to work with, and we worked for a government agency, and we were both really what you would call senior military analysts. Concentrating in things like lessons learned and trends and stuff like that, military stuff. And this individual, a former special forces guy, he basically had a lot of survival skills that he had been cultivating really his whole adult life. And that led him down this road of survivalism and preparedness to quitting his job, moving to Arkansas, somewhere down in the Ozarks, with his flock and creating what's called an intentional community, which we call a commune, is really what it is, based on religion and preparedness. And the religion is kind of an Old Testament-based type of religion. This guy has a lot of stuff on YouTube. So it's kind of a guy about 60, I guess. Looks a lot older because he shaves his head and has a beard. Just to give you some context, I really don't want to bash these people. People can do whatever they want, but when you are basically espousing this back to nature, survivalist preparedness lifestyle, this kind of go back to the 1890s and do a lot of things on your own, no real indoor plumbing, you know, all this kind of stuff. When you espouse that, I mean, you are asking people to live a very different life than what they live in modern society. And when you have your military retirement and your military health care as a safety net, so just in case this all doesn't work out, in case the back to nature stuff really doesn't work out, when you have that as a safety net, you're in a pretty powerful position. But it also makes it so that you really shouldn't be encouraging this lifestyle among people who don't have that kind of a safety net, because they can get out there, and if you don't have healthcare or some sort of outside source of income or something else. If this doesn't work out, you can wind up essentially destitute and without anything, and having to restart your life, having to jumpstart it, and what may be a very disadvantaged position. So I object to people who espouse this without understanding the consequences of this kind of lifestyle choices, and realizing that this could be a much greater risk for somebody who does not have the existing safety net of a military retirement and health care. But be that as it may, and like all communes, this thing is, everyone except immediate family, I think, moved away from it, and I've kind of lost track of it. But one of the things that was definitely encouraged was to read the books Guerrilla Gunfighter 1 and Guerrilla Gunfighter 2. There's some others that the pen name John Mosby has written about forging the heart of the warrior, forging the warrior, and some of these other things. Based on that, I thought I would give it a chance, give it a read, and at least read the one that was most interesting to me, which was The Rifle and Carbine. So I ordered it. And I have to tell you, it was not cheap, but it wasn't outrageous. I mean, there's worse ways to spend money. It was $68 delivered. The book is kind of cheaply made and printed. I mean, it looks kind of like a cheap college textbook type of thing, soft cover. Definitely looks kind of amateurish, no real, very few photographs in it, nothing real or no illustrations. So it's not really what you would consider a $68 book, which you would have pretty high expectations of, but who cares about that? It's about content. So I looked at it strictly from the position of content and really what all that would entail. And I have to tell you that all the hype aside, it just started off bad, and I'll give you an example of where it started off bad. Now, bear in mind, I paid $68 for this, so it kind of goes through the usual acknowledgments and kind of why he wrote the book. There's kind of a long introduction of about, 7 or 8 pages, where he starts off with the acknowledgments and goes from there. Then we have this interesting disclaimer, and it goes, seriously, read this blanking disclaimer. And the blanking is the F word. So we have blanking disclaimer. The following is a manual for training and practice of the skills needed to employ the rifle or carbine in a wide variety of possible contextual environments. Based on my personal experiences working in various environments as a special operations soldier and as a private armed citizen, some of these skills or applications suggested, therefore, may be illegal in any given scenario or situation. In fact, some of them will definitely be illegal. It is up to the reader to determine what skills apply to his or her special environments, and then blah, 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 blah. And then it goes, neither the author nor the publisher assumes any liability for the result of you being a blanking moron and doing stupid shit at inappropriate times in inappropriate places. Don't be stupid. If you decide to be stupid, blank off, you're on your own. That is somewhat less than professional, in my opinion. I kind of read that and said, wow, I paid $68. Bring at me? I mean, come on, man. I mean, I thought that was pretty off-putting. I understand that I think the real deal is they're trying to have this, from the gut, ground truth type book. But I'll tell you, as you read through the book, there are F-bombs all over it. I mean, all over it. There was one point where I was like counting, is there a page without an F-bomb? I mean, you go through this thing. And, that really reeks of unprofessionalism. But what I'm really going to tell you is I'm going to hit this book with a sledgehammer because of what it is and because of really what it does. And I'm tired of people using their resumes to rip off the general public or the gun buying public or the shooting, the gun culture, if you will. And there are enough guys who are using their military resumes as just a commercial ploy to get people to buy these products, even though these products have really nothing to do with military service, have nothing to do with the kind of experience that these individuals claim to have. And let me just start real quick. I don't know John Mosby. Pen name John Mosby is what I'll call him, because I don't know his real name. I wouldn't know. I'd have no background information on the guy other than what he has provided in his book. My sense is he probably joined the military in the very late 1980s or early 1990s and probably retired about 10 years ago. So it's reasonable to presume that this individual had perhaps Gulf War I experience, perhaps deployments to the Balkans, and some measure of experience in the global war on terror, whether that be Afghanistan, Iraq, or in some of the more minor places like the Philippines where Islamic extremists were active. So, you know, the first 150, 160 pages of the book are kind of this rambling thing about, you know, kind of the minds. It goes from mindset to a bit about rifles and kind of gives a warmed over history of the M16. Yeah, we all know it was in Vietnam and the early ones jammed and all, you know, we all know that. We all know that. To go over it again just seems to be filler. And that brings me to my first real criticism of the book, and that is, as it's a self-published or amateurly published type book, when it first arrives, you know, you can tell it's kind of cheaply made. But like I said earlier, you're looking for content. It's like double or it's actually looks triple spaced. So the giant book really doesn't hold that much content, really doesn't. And there are really no diagrams and pictures, a couple of small ones. But, you know, so everything in there is just kind of this verbiage. And it really lacks a structure. It really lacks an outline of what it's going to be. The funniest part is it's got a thing where it tells you the chapter 1, page 10, chapter 2, page 11, whatever it is. And it doesn't tell you that the chapters don't really have titles that you can research by. So it's really oddly done that way. The first half of the book really kind of sounds like a very unstructured college paper on a variety of things and mindset. You know, do you have the warrior mindset? And this pen named John Mosby has written a book on the warrior mind, forging the warrior or something. And I assume that has mindset. I'm not going to buy it to find out. Based on this book, I'm not buying any other ones. I'll tell you that straight up. So, and then it kind of goes through a little thing of equipment, history of the rifle, why the AR-15 is the greatest rifle that ever was, why people who use other things probably aren't very smart. And it goes on and on. None of that I particularly agree with, but if there is an overarching framework, it is in the fact that this is written for a dystopian type of scenario where, you know, essentially it's everything doesn't work anymore and there is no rule of law. Therefore, you will not be held accountable for your actions, which I think is a huge mistake. It's a huge mistake for a couple different reasons. And I think that's why that portion that I read to you, the disclaimer, was read, because he's talking about doing things that are not going to pass any kind of legal scrutiny. If you're in a grid down situation, you know, those don't last forever. And, you know, whether it's a hurricane or an earthquake, and there are giant faults in the United States, there's even if this whole super volcano in Yellowstone goes, you could be for a period of time, however long is up to your guess, without the benefits of modern society. But those will eventually return, because that's how it is. If the government's going to be gone forever, then maybe that's a whole different world. But the chance of that happening is very, very small. And the chance of any individual survivalist surviving that with their truckload of goodies and their self-sustaining ranchette out where they're growing their own rabbits and chickens and all this. And they have their fighting rifle and they fight off the hordes. That seems to be fantasy world to me. That has really been influenced by a lot of movies, starting probably from The Omega Man with Charlton Heston. And these movies are great and they're entertaining. You know, The Postman with Kevin Costner. There have been TV series, you know, Jericho, the TV series, all these things. There's a lot of those kind of post-apocalyptic movies. And, you know, they can't really shape what your environment is. So where this leads is, where this really goes is, he recommends building a rifle that's got an optic on it that has, like, you know, 1.5 to 8 power, or I think they have them 1.5 to 10 power, depending on how much you're really going to spend. The rest of it is pretty standard M4 fare, you know, the things. I will tell you that that's probably, that's a way to go. That's a way to go. But the fact of the matter is, in any survival situation that you are most likely to encounter, to the 99 percentile, you're going to be using your fighting rifle at essentially handgun ranges. And even the U.S. Army recognizes that. I mean, EOTechs and aim points are not magnified. And most of your combat rifle fighting is going to be done under 100 yards. So to build a capability on your rifle to shoot out way beyond that is probably not the wisest thing to do, because you really want one set up for what they call CQB, whatever deal. But it's close range fighting. It's what I call the red zone, which is out to about 25 meters. Beyond the red zone, you kind of have a yellow zone that goes out to 75 or 100 meters. You know, depending on where you are, what kind of terrain you're in, those are going to be it. You cannot legally justify being on your property and you see somebody who looks like a bad dude who's armed and you smoke him from 250 yards away. That is going to look like murder. And I don't know where you are in the country, but I know where you will be. You'll be behind bars if you do that, even in a grid down situation. It's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to prove that you're under a physical threat unless they're shooting at you from that distance, and in which case they shouldn't even be seeing you. So I would be very wary about accepting this as advice. Now, I'm not going to say the book is all bad. It does have some nuggets in there. And one of the nuggets that I think is positive is, essentially, you know, slings are worthless. Slings are usually not that great a thing. Most people have a two-point sling, so they can sling the rifle over their shoulder. I actually prefer to use an M60 sling, M60 machine gun sling, because it's got a big pad on it, and I've kind of shortened it up so that it fits about right, and I can just sling my rifle, throw it around over my back if I need to use my hands, or I can just kind of let it hang, and I have reasonable use of both my hands. These slings that are three-point slings that come across your body, and that if you just pull on this one, it tightens the weapon up, and then you let this one go and it tightens it. I found those things to be uniformly trash. And the reason they're trash is because they're too complicated. They may be very well made, but if you're wearing any kind of gear, those things get caught on everything. They're awkward. They block your magazine pouches. They get in the way. And he is of the same opinion that these things are worse than useless. I have several that were actually given to me by operators, guys who said, "Hey, you want a rifle sling?" And I'm like, "Hey, it's free. I'll take it." And then when I try these things out, I see why they got rid of it. They're not useful. So that is more Geardo stuff. It's gear stuff. So I would be very, very cautious of slings. Single point slings, again, where the rifle's just kind of flopping around at the end of a single deal. I don't like those either. There's no real good sling arrangement. They all are a compromise. And in point of fact, the old canvas, U.S. military M1 sling is probably just as good as anything else for taking up a hasty sling position or hauling an AR across your back. But hey, it's up to you. It's up to you what you want. I would also say that with these contraption slings or even any other sling is, you know, get it adjusted to the length that's good for you. If you're gonna do that, keep it at a single length. And then 100 mile an hour tape, which was the military duct tape that thing so that just in case it pulls loose or something, the rifle doesn't, you know, fall to the ground and get crunched. So, you know, that's the thing I would tell people to do. And that's where I think the rifle should go. I mean, you're not going to do long-range engagements, so why set up a rifle for that? It goes to over-scoping rifles, which I think is a mistake a lot of people make. They want to put large and powerful optics on essentially small weapons that are designed to be handy. And we talked about this in another podcast. I'm a minimalist when it comes to junk on a rifle because the more stuff you put on, the heavier it becomes and the less agile it becomes. It's heavier and it's harder to swing, harder to move around. And so rather than fight it, I like to keep things minimal. The other thing is your rifle does not have to be the same kind of thing that a tier one operator would use in what's known as SF Operational Detachment Delta, which we call Delta Force in the vernacular. You know, that's what people know it as. You don't need the fanciest and greatest things hanging on your rifle if you're a civilian and you're looking to defend yourself. Really, if it's going to be something that you're afraid there's going to be night things, you either need a good light or you need some sort of night vision capability. And I'm a fan of, hey, you know, good iron sights are good, especially if you're talking under 100 yards. You don't need to get fancy, but my preference is the EOTech. So you can take all that for what it is. The next point that I think is really kind of a poor point in the book is pen name John Mosby goes through ammunition selection. And of course, he does not like the 55 grain loads for 5.56. He is more of a 62 grain ball M855 kind of guy. He thinks it's superior accuracy, it's distances. There's been a lot of different viewpoints on that. I'm saying if you're shooting at 100 yards or less, then 55 grain is preferable because it's got a little bit higher velocity, it's damaging, and it does the job, and it did the job very, very well for many years. So that's what I would go with. The 62 grain stuff has been bagged that, you know, it lowers the velocity, therefore it doesn't transfer the kinetic energy as well. It seems to kind of drill a hole in a target as opposed to having a more catastrophic wound effect. And its accuracy has been pinged. They don't, high power rifle shooters avoid it like the plague. So be that as it may, I would not take that advice either. I think that's poor. Again, you get about halfway through the book, and it doesn't take long to do that because, like I said, it's triple spaced and it rambles on and on in the very beginning. Then you start getting to some of the drills and things that are in it. And I was looking for the way that our friend the pastor in Arkansas had hyped this. That here was a guy who'd done a lot of foreign internal defense, meaning pen name Mosby, a lot of security force assistance type missions. So he was used to training people who had rudimentary skill levels and that his training recommendations would reflect that, i.e. you would see, you know, kind of lesson plans or a little lesson package of start off with these skills and then progress to these other things. And you really don't see that. The drills in there are, you know, they're just drills. And every trainer has got his own vision of what those should look like. And, and counting the numbers, you know, numbering each target and screaming the number out and having the shooter engage that number. That's pretty old stuff. The Marines have done some of that. And so none of that strikes me as being really current or being really wow. You know, this is the same kind of stuff you can get on shooting forums. So why would you buy the $68 book? I don't know. But there really wasn't anything gee willikers in all that. I didn't see any kind of lesson plans, any kind of things. And again, it's focused on a single individual, not really any talk about, hey, a team. Even if it's just your immediate family, you know, what can different people do? And so we get this solo Superman, Omega Man type of training scenario that really doesn't make any sense. It doesn't reflect reality. It doesn't reflect what pen name John Mosby probably did in the military, where he was a member of what I'm assuming would be a highly trained team. These books are just fantasy books, and you know, your $68 is a lot better spent on buying ammo or buying a good piece of gear for yourself that you're actually going to use and find useful. There is a companion to this one. This is actually Volume 2, the rifle and carbine. Volume 1 is the handgun. I can tell you I will pass on that, and I will pass on the rest of pen name Mosby's writings based on this book. I don't like it, as I said earlier, I don't like it when people use their military resumes, especially now when the flavor of the week is special operations and they flaunt that resume to sell junk to the unsuspecting public, and to sell this kind of rambling just doesn't cut it. It's not, you're not getting your money's worth out of this. And I can only recommend that you pass on this. Don't walk away, run away from this book. There's a lot of other things. I could go pick this thing apart all day long, but I think in the 30 minutes I've covered this, you get the idea. The idea is there is no magic book that you can buy that will turn you into an operator that is a special operations type person. There just isn't. But there are things you can do, and what you can do that this book does not cover is go get some basic safety training. Take a couple of these rifle classes from, it doesn't have to be the national guys, but maybe local guys, that kind of stuff. Learn how to do controlled pairs. Learn how to do a double tap. Practice engaging out to 100 yards quickly and accurately, and you know, you will be well ahead of the pack. You will be very, very well prepared to fight with your rifle. I'll leave it up to you whether three-gun matches are going to be worthwhile. I personally think they have too much gamer gear. And if you go into it with common sense, martial artist type gear, the stuff you'd actually use in the real world, I think you might find that to be a frustrating experience. But hey, that's, you know, your mileage may vary on that. But I strongly recommend learn how to handle your weapon, get familiar with it, and learn how to engage targets quickly. That's the crux of all of this. The warrior mindset stuff, hey, I leave that for another day and another discussion. I always assume that by the time somebody's looking for a book like this, they've already made up their mind, and they are, you know, they've already got all that. And I'm also assuming they're not looking for the history of the M16 and jamming in Vietnam and blah, 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 blah. They're not looking for all that junk. They're looking for some realistic techniques that they can educate themselves on by using this book and perhaps practice even in a square range environment or an environment of a range where they can perhaps move a bit forwards and backwards, or choose the range at which they're going to engage their targets. So that's what I think they're looking for. This book does not deliver. You will rue purchasing it, so I cannot recommend it. What I can do, though, is tell you that be a discriminating buyer. and realize that there's a whole cottage industry out there of the pastor in Arkansas, who's the former Special Forces guy who's been hyping this stuff. There's a bunch of people on podcasts that hype all of their experience and everything else. When somebody's trying to sell you something, that's when I beware. That's when you got to hang on to your wallet and say, whoa, what is this? And those guys are out there. And some of them are good guys. I mean, they're very, you know, they had great careers or whatever it is they did. But if they're out there selling you something, whether it's a multi-point sling, or whether it's the new tourniquet they designed, or whether it's their book that's going to, you know, transform you from, you know, it reminds me of the old ads that they would talk about in the backs of comic books, you know, the guy who gets sand kicked in his face on the beach and he orders the Charles Atlas bodybuilding thing. And, you know, some short period of time later, he's on the beach all muscle bound and all the girls are around him. No, there's no book that's going to do that for you. But it's a tried and true method of getting you to, you know, buy one over the internet or send in to buy one. So, you know, be very aware. They're preying upon your trust in their resumes, and they're using those things to the max. So, you know, I say that the best thing you can do is, you know, there are a lot of forums. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. Most of them have some good information, some poor information. But, you know, look at what skills you're going to need. Look at the environment you're going to be in. And you're going to see, look around your neighborhood or look around where your cabin is. You're not going to see a lot of long-range shots. There's not going to be the Chris Kyle, you know, on the roof in downtown somewhere racking up a body count. That's just not going to happen. And even if you did that, there are legal consequences. Just like there would be on a shooting tomorrow. If you did a self-defense shooting tomorrow, there are going to be legal consequences. The book that probably pen name John Mosby should have read before he wrote his book was In the Gravest Extreme, and we've talked about that before. Okay, before I leave this, I just want to talk about one other thing. There's a big long thing about magazines in the book. And what I'll say is what I've said on the podcast before. The best magazines are the ones that are well-maintained and have been tested and performed. If it's tested and it's maintained, it's a good magazine. And that doesn't matter if it's a GI magazine or one of the aftermarket magazines that's out there. Pen name John Mosby is partial to Magpul magazines, and they are not a bad choice. I don't like them for several reasons. Number one is if you have more than one AR platform, sometimes there's a slight dimensional difference in AR magazine wells, and some are a little bit tighter fit than others. So consequently, some magazines fit better than others. And with a Magpul magazine, that's usually something that's aggravated with a Magpul magazine. The other thing I don't really care about them is they're heavier. They're about 25%. Empty magazine is about 25% heavier than a USGI steel magazine. Or I'm sorry, USGI aluminum magazine. In fact, the only real problem I've ever had with USGI aluminum magazines are dents to the magazine body. It's game over for the magazine at that point. They're inexpensive enough that you really don't need to tweak with them. So if you get a dent in the magazine body, that's usually a sign that they're a goner. The other thing that happens is the feed lips can get deformed, but that's a pretty rare occurrence. I haven't seen that hardly at all. It's usually in a magazine that's been, you know, out in the field on exercises, maneuvers, and somehow it gotten crunched by some other piece of equipment. On rifle ranges, I've never actually seen that. So that's a pretty rare occurrence. And when that happens, hey, it's game over for that magazine too. But they're inexpensive enough so that you can replace it. And that's the beauty of the AR magazines, is they are that way. One of the last things on about the book is he claims, pen name Mosby claims, that the ARs and M16s were supposedly going to have preloaded disposable magazines. That, as near as I can tell, is not true. There was some, that was an option with the early AR-10s, which were in 7.62 NATO. The thought was that they would be in a weak aluminum magazine that would essentially be disposable. You would just, you're just like the end block clips in World War II, the ammunition came prepackaged in those. Your ammunition would come prepackaged in these disposable magazines. Of course, I don't have to tell you what a bad idea that is. A very bad idea indeed. And it never followed through. The aluminum magazine was never, for the M16, was never designed to be disposable. It was designed to be something that was replaceable, but not disposable. And when it got to the point where it had had enough use and it had been dented or damaged the way that I had have stated before, that you could replace it. It was a very low-cost item, and you can replace it, and there you go. And that's the way we should treat them today. So, again, to wrap this up, finally, and give my moment's peace, I will say do not buy this book. And if you get a copy of it, if you find one in the garbage somewhere, they'll love me for saying that. But if you find one in the trash or at a bus stop or something, and you read it, I would take it with a large grain of salt. That while you might find an occasional nugget in there that you find useful, it is certainly not worth the $68 of the book plus shipping that they will charge you. And you know, if you don't like reading the F word every page or every other page or whatever it works out to, you won't like this book. It's just not there. So there it is, the story of the Guerrilla Gunfighter Volume 2 Rifle and Carbine. Oh, I thought that drubbing this book would take an entire podcast, but I do have some extra time here I can fill. And frankly, again, I don't really want to bash things, but that just irked me. So anyway, a couple other things I just wanted to tell you is, obviously, we're in the fight of our lives for gun rights. I'm glad that the NRA is suing the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco. Those people are scum. You know, San Francisco is a horrible city. I actually lived there for a long time during my later high school and college days. And I was pretty much a misfit there. I'd come off a cattle ranch in extreme northern California, right near the Oregon border, and I was kind of plopped into San Francisco. So I wasn't a really good fit. But it was a very beautiful city at that time. It was really a jewel. And, you know, it was fairly safe. There were still some things going on there. The Patty Hearst kidnapping had happened, and there was the zebra killing. And a few years before, the zebra killings were a bunch of Black Panther radical types who were out shooting white people at bus stops. And frankly, they were stopped by other people in the Black community turning them in because they said that was unacceptable. So it wasn't a thing that set the races against each other. It was something where everybody kind of worked together to solve a problem. But before that, there had been the Zodiac thing. So San Francisco is kind of a wild and woolly place, but it has degenerated to the point where I had a family member who lived and worked there for a couple of years stretch, and the city has turned into something awful. I mean, you see the things on Facebook about the poop maps where homeless people are pooping all over the place. And that is so bad. It is so bad that there's an anti-wealth kind of anti-capitalist thing going on there, to the point where this family member witnessed a homeless woman, you know, the usual kind of, you know, pretty grody looking homeless woman. She climbed up on top of a new Lexus and defecated on it. Defecated on somebody's car simply because they're doing well enough to be able to afford a Lexus. I have heard stories of people who own Corvettes. You know, Corvette is a very, very nice car, very expensive car. And people who drive Corvettes in San Francisco, if you leave it parked any place, it gets keyed, it gets kicked, it, a lot of things because there's a lot of anti-capitalist anger, and people do. And I wouldn't doubt that these cars get weed upon and pooped upon. I mean, it's a very, very ugly place in many ways. And for them to label the NRA as a terrorist organization with all the military, police, and other members that are in the NRA in public service, the private citizens who want to enjoy the outdoors, and people who are very, very concerned about the country and gun rights and having a legacy of sportsmanship, whether it's target shooting or whatever it is that they can pass on to succeeding generations. To label that organization as a terrorist organization is horrible. And I hope that the lawsuit at least embarrasses them. Even the liberal media seems to have kind of laughed at that and think that that was a pretty stupid move. And it was. One that's a little closer to home, which I really, really am very disappointed about, is, of course, Walmart deciding not to sell pistol ammunition and to discontinue certain calibers of rifle ammunition, namely 223/556, 7.62x39, and 7.62x51. And I'm assuming that will extend into 308 Winchester. I don't really know. I don't really buy a lot of ammo at Walmart. To me, it's just kind of a place where you can kind of get some stuff. You know, the prices for ammo really weren't that great. I would say that I got a Cabela's that's just a few more minutes away, and then I prefer to buy ammo from SG Ammo. Buying it in bulk saves a lot of money, and frankly, I'd rather give them the money than Walmart. You know, from its inception, Walmart used to have a lot of Made in America products, and they probably still pay some lip service to that. But in reality, it's the harbor freight of big box stores. It is nothing more than a storefront for the latest Chinese-made piece of junk. And frankly, their grocery department can be disgusting. It's absolutely, you know, if there's a place worthy of boycott, it is Walmart. Remember, it wasn't too long ago, and I'm sure it still happens, that Walmart was such a poor salary payer that they actually had a company book on, you know, government benefits that basically were paying you so little that you're going to qualify for, you know, welfare and other government benefits. So here's how you apply for them. So essentially, we as taxpayers were paying their corporate benefit package. And that's BS. You know, I saw some little factoid. And again, this is, you never know how true this is, but it says that the Walton family makes like $800,000 an hour from their holdings in Walmart, which is a fantastic amount of money when you think about it. Fantastic. I'm skeptical that it's that much, but hey, could be. But my viewpoint is they're no longer worthy. I don't care if they're still going to sell hunting ammunition. I don't need 270 Winchester. I don't. If I need 30-30, I'm going to buy it from Cabela's. I don't want to give Walmart the dollar. It doesn't matter what they're still going to carry. What matters is, do I want to give them my money for anything? And the answer is, I'm going on a Walmart diet. I'm not going to spend any money there. I've got local. I would rather pay more for a local business than save $50 by going to Walmart, because Walmart doesn't appreciate my business. Because they just cut off something that was very important, I think, to communities. And it was a convenience to me. I will tell you that occasionally you could go in there and find where they rolled back the prices on something. And it was worth buying the pack of 200 rounds of 5.56 or something. You know, that's, or if you need it, you're going to have a range day. You're going to take some people out to the range. Hey, you pick up one of those and there you go. You have plenty, you know, and you're not trying to manage 10, 20 round boxes that are flopping around everywhere. So, but I can buy those other places, and I will. So Walmart, hasta la vista, baby. And we will hopefully see you when they're shuttering your stores. And, you know, when you ask, why aren't people buying there? Look back at your ammo ban. The paltry amount of money I have doesn't make a difference to you, but there are thousands and thousands and thousands of me's out there. And you've just turned this into a silent boycott, where we're going to boycott you and we're not going to give you our money, and, you know, figure out how your business is going to go. But that wasn't a very smart thing to do. Not a very smart thing to do at all. And lastly, before we wrap this up, the whole podcast, I would like to say, please support the NRA. It's been a tough year for the NRA. It's been a tough year, but we've got the fight of our lives ahead of us. Congress is coming back from summer recess, and they want gun control. And you know it'll pass the House, because it is now in the hands. The House of Representatives is in the wrong hands. It is in the wrong hands. If you value freedom, if you value the Bill of Rights, if you value any amendment of the Constitution, but most explicitly the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, the House of Representatives is in the wrong hands. And the Senate is perilously close to being in the wrong hands also. And the political pressure on President Donald Trump to do something is immense. And it is a testimony to the power and the formidable stature of the NRA that basically we've been able to hold this off at least until now, and hopefully until this passes. But believe it, this is now, gun control is where we don't want it to be. It is a first and foremost issue, and it is going to be a big campaign issue in 2020. We've got to get out there, or else 10 years from now, we'll be talking about the good old days, and the good old days will be gone. The good old days will be gone, and they'll be nothing more than memories. So it's up to us. It is up to us whether freedom becomes a faded memory or not. And we have to fight. And the guys on the front lines, the best weapon we have is the National Rifle Association of America, which represents, in many ways, 120 million legal gun owners, law-abiding legal gun owners, and we have a mobilized membership of 5 million people who can make a big difference, but need help. So get out and do your part. Preserve freedom. This may not be as dramatic as Omaha Beach, but the consequences may be just as dire, because lost freedom is almost impossible to recover. And that closes us up for Old School Guns. And if you like what you hear, hit any one of those buttons I mentioned at the top of the podcast. If you hate what you hear, tell your friends. And you can always leave me comments on Podbean. And if you get a Podbean account, you know, it's really easy. You can get right in there and leave me a comment. But we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your questions. And we will include you in the next question and answer portion of our next podcast. So anyway, this is Old School Guns out.